hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode, a long-awaited episode after quite the hiatus of the No Better Than Average podcast. This is episode 130. I am your co-host, Jacob Cazell, and with me tonight is Todd Singer. Jeff is fighting a beastly headache and is not joining us, so hopefully he takes some of the some of that Excedrin and feels better real soon, and we'll get him back on the show. So we're here with more tech stuff. To do a little bit of housekeeping up front. If you've got any questions, comments, I know it's been a long time since we've been on the air. We would love to hear from you, and you can give us a call at 317-643-1212. And if you'd like to get our newsletter sent to you eventually one of these days, you can subscribe to that by going to nobettershow.com/join. We'd be happy to send it out occasionally. I think we've sent one, maybe two out in the year and a half, that 2 years that we've had it. So we will not overwhelm you, and we won't sell your information. So you can do that if you'd like. Todd, how are you doing this fine day?
Hey, I'm doing fine. I survived a day at the state fair here in central Indiana. Actually, it was a really nice day to go. It was sort of rainy a lot. Like drizzly and stuff, so it wasn't that crowded.
That's nice, because the fair can be awful in August in central Indiana.
Yeah, we've been there on some of those days, but this was, kind of cool, cool temperature-wise, and I saw, when I was there, an extreme drop test.
Oh, so of what?
Yeah, so we're on the midway. My wife and daughter and our cousin were standing in line for a ride. My son and I were sitting on a bench waiting for them to do that because he'd already done his ride before. And I'm watching this big ride. I have to describe it. It's like a straight up thing, straight up and down. And then at the top are like four seats, two harnesses on each side, and at the bottom, four seats on each side. And that thing just, once it starts, it just spins around, and the people are kind of free floating. So they're like turning upside down. And sometimes it's called speed at the fair. Anyways, huge ride. I mean, that thing is probably 50 feet up in the air at the top. I don't know, something like that. It's really high. And I'm sitting there watching because, there's nothing else to do. And I noticed that I see an object in the air, and then that object proceeds to do what most objects in the air do, and that is fall and clatter to the ground. And even when I first saw it, I started walking over toward it. By the time I get over there, it landed about, 5 feet from a guy who was like freaking out, looking around, looking up, what happened? It was an iPhone.
Oh, of course.
And to give iPhone credit, it was not in a million little pieces. It was in two separate pieces. and I didn't get a chance to investigate it all that closely, but that was probably about a 50-foot drop. The ride operator came over and got it, and turned around, went back. And not 10 seconds later, a pocket knife lands in the same area. I don't know if it was the same person's stuff, but yeah, it was pretty exciting.
That's an interesting adjective for it. I would think more terrifying than exciting. If knives and phones are falling from 50 feet, that's gonna hurt. If it's gonna leave a mark if it hits you,
it would. Fortunately, both objects just hit the pavement. It didn't hit anybody. So
wow. Yeah, that's impressive. That I'm assuming the screen popped off of the iPhone.
I think so. Like I said, I didn't get a chance to look at it that closely, but there were definitely two different parts that the guy had. I don't know if it was amazingly like a case, or more likely, it was probably the screen. Huh. And they say the rides at the state fair are expensive, and it certainly was expensive for that gentleman.
$800 ride.
gentleman or lady. I don't know which. So, yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't know how I feel about the fair rides now after that accident a couple of weeks ago in Ohio. Yeah, I think I would probably steer clear of a ride that whips around upside down 50-some feet in the air. That's a little terrifying.
You know, and I agree, although it's probably the safest time to ride them is right now. They've probably been over and over and over them, so at this point for safety checks.
And you would hope that a fair might be better inspected. There's a Marsh supermarket that is no more, not too far from my house, and they have a big, giant, empty parking lot, and apparently a carny has been set up there for about 3 weeks now. And it's one of those parking lot carnivals that you see from time to time, and usually you see them there for like a weekend, maybe for a week, and then they're gone, and they just kind of blow in and blow out. But this one's been there for 3 weeks now, probably. And I'm sure they're probably getting a real good deal on leasing the parking lot because there's nobody there. I mean, it's a big empty building, and it's a big grocery store-sized parking lot. And we happen to, there's a little Mexican restaurant over at the end of the former Marsh that is pretty good. They make a decent plate of fajitas. And we went for dinner there, a week or so ago. And of course, when you have a seven-year-old with you, all they see is the Ferris wheel and the flashing lights and the midway and the food booths. And there was a full-on freak out about wanting to go to this carnival, which we were able to successfully defuse, but it was touch and go there for just a little bit. And in looking at, I mean, the rides were there were people there, and it was right after that accident in Ohio, and the rides just looked really sketchy, and the carny folk looked really sketchy, and yeah, I don't think I would want to go and trust myself to that. I feel like there's a lower level of inspection on that kind of stuff. That's not good. I had actually talked with my wife about going to the fair this year, and we started looking at the pricing, and I didn't remember the fair being as expensive as it was. General admission tickets are $12. I thought they were like $6 or $7. When did the fair get so expensive to start going to?
We got it was a 4-person pass and parking for $30.
Okay, that's not so bad.
It's not, but I mean, the fare is expensive. I mean, the rides are expensive, even if you don't have to replace a cell phone.
The food's expensive. Yeah, it's all expensive. Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff to do once you get in, though, that doesn't cost anything. So, you know, I mean, we spent the whole day there. I don't know what all we paid, or, you know, we probably paid, say, right around $100 total for the whole thing. For a whole day for four people.
It's not bad. $1 for, you know, for your value for entertainment, right?
The best place that, as far as food for value, and I've probably said this before, is the Indiana Dairy Barn, because their grilled cheese sandwiches are $3 and their ice cream is $3.
But that doesn't
sound
like
that price.
That doesn't sound like it's nearly bad enough for you, because I didn't hear the word deep fried at all in that description.
No, the fried stuff, that's a young man's game. I can't do that stuff anymore. So I don't even search it out. I had a beef brisket sandwich. Ooh. at the beef tent, which was delicious. And the stop at the dairy barn, pretty good. And you know, the kids got slushies and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
it's a good day. It's a little pricey. It's definitely not cheap. It's definitely not a cheap day, but it's
You only do it once a year, maybe every other year, something like that. Very cool. Yeah, we haven't really done a whole lot recently. We did just get back from a little family vacation to the lake down in Kentucky, and we also stopped at Mammoth Cave, which I have attempted to go several times. The trick with Mammoth Cave is if you just show up thinking, I'm going to go look at a hole in the ground, you can't, because you can't buy a tour ticket day of. You have to pre-buy your tour tickets.
Oh my gosh.
So I've been there like four times thinking, well, maybe this time. And, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So this year we were prepared, and my lovely wife went and bought tour tickets. Now, I've managed to make it to 41 years on this earth and have never been to Mammoth Cave and seen it. Now, I caved in high school. Like, we used to go caving. We had a club. You know, I've overnighted in caves. I I am intimately familiar with crawling around in a dirty hole in the ground, but I'd never done Mammoth Cave and didn't think I was going to be that blown away by it because I've done real caving, but it was amazing. I don't know if you've ever done any of the tours there, but I want to go back. They offer, we did the historic tour, which is about 2 hours and I don't know, it's maybe 2 miles. And it's really nice because it's all on a paved walkway and it's mostly steps. There's a few tight places and whatnot, but you can get around pretty easy. But they apparently do like a 6 or 8 hour tour that they give you a hard hat and a light and coveralls and like you go shimmy through the cave, which now I kind of want to go back and do that one. So yeah, definitely two big thumbs up the Mammoth Cave tour. It was really, really fascinating just learning the history of it and whatnot. I had no idea that and his name is escaping me, the doctor that bought it way back when, who had a slave named Stephen Bishop. But 200 years ago, they were giving tours of the cave. You could actually go and take a tour of the cave 200 years ago. And there's all this graffiti in the cave that, I mean, you'll see dates of people who've written their names up on the walls, like, you know, 1902, 1845, 1940. And it just, it's amazing. So, yeah, had a good time, back to the grind and all that fun stuff. Summer's officially over. My kid's back in school. I don't know if yours are yet, but if not, they're probably close.
Yes, they are.
So, yeah, summer is officially over and all that fun stuff.
I'd like to put Mammoth Cave on the list of things to check out. We've been to, which one is it? It's over by St. Louis. It's about an hour west of St. Louis. I can't think of it now, but it's like warm year-round. And
really?
It's kind of the same thing. It's been private for quite a while, so they've been giving tours for quite a while. And, you know, they've got the nice stalactite, mm-hmm. rooms and pretty colors, and it's pretty good.
That's interesting. It's fascinating. Yeah, I'd never been in anything as big underground as Mammoth Cave. It definitely lives up to its name. And I think there's almost 500 miles of caverns that they've explored so far. And I seem to remember reading something a year or so ago that they actually found a connection to another giant cave, which was going to add like 100 kilometers or 100 miles of passages. And it was by far, I mean, it's the biggest cave system in the world by like twice as much as the next closest cave. It's unfathomably large. So
Merrimack Cave.
Oh yeah.
For those of you playing at home, that's the one that I was thinking of.
Very cool. Well, we actually have some listener feedback, and I just wanted to read this on air. I have not had a chance to respond yet. This is from Scott C., who wrote in and said, "Longtime listener, first-time emailer. I was checking out the website, and I noticed someone lacking on our bio page. No Todd! Not that I would want to know any more about him as his brother-in-law. I probably know too much already. But really, there may be others out there in the great world of the internet, parentheses capital I, that would. Maybe he is just bio worthy. Keep up the good work. I love the show. Oh, and Jacob, stay out of the tree, Scott." So thank you, Scott. We will in fact remedy that. We are sorely non-diligent. What's the opposite of diligent? Disdiligent? Anti-diligent in maintaining our web page. There is probably an antonym out there somewhere.
Yeah, there was a bio, I think, on the first time I actually co-hosted, so, but I don't know is or where it is.
Yeah, we actually need to probably write it up and slap a picture up there and all that fun stuff. So thank you, Scott, for pointing that out. We will attempt to remedy that and make Todd official. I mean, it's been, probably close to a year now, at least, hasn't it? I'd have to go back and look, but it was last summer.
I have no idea, yeah.
I think it was last summer. So
sure.
I'm going to have to go back and look. So what say you, Todd? How about we talk about some tech stuff now that we've bored all these people with the fairs and caves and all of that fun stuff?
Sounds good.
You know, a story has popped up this last week. I don't know how much traction it's gotten because my wife is a user of it and she knew nothing about it. And so I don't know if this is one that's gotten around, but I have been a longtime advocate of, passionate user of LastPass, which is a password management tool. I have been a LastPass premium subscriber for a long, long time. It was $12 a year and it worked really well. So $1 a month, and it gave you syncing between the desktop version, web version, and the mobile version, and totally worth it. I think I've been a customer LastPass for like close to 5 years, and they just announced that starting, I think, September 1st, they are doubling their prices. They are also eliminating a couple of features from the free platform. I don't know all of them off the top of my head. I believe they are taking the emergency contact option away. Apparently, there was a way you could set up sort of like a fallback. If you lost your access to LastPass, you could designate an emergency contact that they could get in touch with and verify who you were and would restore your access. There were some sharing options in the free plan that they are taking away. So now it's going to be $2 a month, $24 a year, which, you know, that just rustled my jimmies because they're not giving you anything more for it. You're literally getting nothing. They're adding no features. They're adding nothing. They're just raising the price.
Do you want to feel better? I've been a customer of Dashlane for a few years, and it's $40 a year.
Well, I was going to say the caveat to that is everything else is more expensive. Dashlane is $39.95, I think, or $39.99. Yeah. 1Password, which I know that it has a lot of adherence, I think it's about $36 or $40 a year. And unfortunately, 1Password only plays nice across the macOS, iOS world. So if you're all Apple all the time, I think 1Password is a no-brainer. But if you have to dip your toes into the Windows world, like I do, then 1Password falls down. They don't really have a good solution on the Windows side. There are some other options. One that I actually looked at trying to see if I could make a change just on principle, because it angers me that they raise their price for no reason whatsoever. Well, they want more money, but they're not giving us anything. Like, give me something, make it worth, you know, justify that doubling for something. And, you know, okay, it's only $24 a year. It's not going to break me. But it's the same company that bought LogMeIn a few years ago that had a very loyal customer base. And then they just yanked the free tier away and really irritated a lot of people. Well, they're doing the same thing again with LastPass.
Is it Martin Shkreli? Martin Shkreli buy it?
No, unfortunately, I think he is out of commission now, right? He's been found guilty.
Guilty of something.
Guilty of gouging customers?
I think it was fraud.
Oh, anyway. On fraud? I haven't followed that story closely enough.
Me either.
Yeah, so I don't really know what to do. I played with one last week trying to decide if I could find a change. I know Dashlane has a lot of fans and it's supposed to be really nice, but I don't want to spend even more. I looked at one called InPass, which I think is about the same price, but it's not nearly as nice as LastPass. It doesn't integrate as well. So I'm kind of torn. I don't know what to do. I really like LastPass, but I'm really irritated by the old, hey, let's just charge twice as much and give you nothing. And not even really, they didn't even really try and, spin it as why, like, it's going to be more stable, it's going to be better, we're going to be better positioned to do it. No, it's just basically, the price is now $24 a year. Award-winning password management for $2 a month. Well, it was award-winning password management for $1 a month just last week. So that kind of irritates me. So if you are a LastPass user, if I have managed to convert you, I apologize. And secondly, be aware those prices are going up. My subscription actually expires in October. So I got a little bit of time to figure out if I'm going to stick with them and what I'm going to do. If maybe one of our listeners out there has another alternative that's not as expensive as a Dashlane, we'd be happy to hear it. I've not looked at Dashlane. I definitely take a look at that. Do you know, Todd, does Dashlane offer any sort of a family plan?
Gosh, I just had that up and I closed it. I think the premium pretty much is. I mean, my wife uses it. I use it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever locked us out. I can't remember like ever being locked out for any reason. So
right.
I think the $40 basically is a family plan. Let's see what's got here. Unlimited storage. Yeah, I don't see anything that has any limitations on it. So
yeah, that might be one to look into. And I know that LastPass is actually adding a new plan. It's $48 a year, and it's a family plan. I believe that they let you have 6 profiles with that, and they give you a dashboard to manage those accounts, and you can easily say, you know, profile 1 can share these credentials with profiles 2 and 6. And it can share, and profiles 2 can share credentials with profile, blah, blah. So you could mix and match and all that. But I don't want to go from paying $12 a month to paying $48 if I'm not really getting anything. If I could switch to a Dashlane for $40 and cover my needs and my wife's needs, that might make a lot of sense.
We just have one log on. And as I see here, it says Dashlane on unlimited devices. And okay. Again, so far, I have not run into any. I've got it on tablet. Every time I get a new phone, just put on a new phone. Laptop that I'm on now, desktop upstairs, work laptop, they all work.
Yeah, I'll have to take a look at Dashlane. I've heard really good things about it. I'm sure we could make that work for us. Right now, we just share. That's one nice thing that LastPass does, is it allows you to share credentials where it's technically my credential, but it's shared with my wife's account so she can use it, and vice versa. If I update it, it automatically updates in her side. But then, you know, there's stuff that she's got, like I have no interest in ever logging into her JCPenney account, and she can have that, mm-hmm. and I don't ever have to see it and all that fun stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll have to play with it. But yeah, it's got me a little irritated there, LastPass. You're not winning any friends. The whole internet is a little grumpy at you.
It says right here in your notes, the company has said on Facebook, the updated pricing reflects our investment in new features.
But they haven't offered any new features.
But
they said it.
Obviously invested in new features. It says it right on their Facebook page.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a lot of things that people say that aren't true. And I think that's the thing from some of the threads and some of the messages that I've been reading. I think most people are like, yeah, it's only $2 a month. It's only $24 a year. That's not going to break me. But they're not giving me anything. It's the principle of it. If they would have at least come out and given me a bone, like, hey, we're going to add this feature. We're going to give you that capability. Okay, it makes it a little easier to swallow that pill. But they're not doing that. Mm. And not giving us any honey with that pill. So. I don't know. It angers me. I saw an interesting article, and you know, we've talked a lot about Xiaomi, and this article just popped up last week that says that Xiaomi is now selling more wearables than Apple or Fitbit, which is interesting because, you know, for the longest time Fitbit was the king of the hill on, you know, wearables, and then I mean it's. I don't know about the people that you work with or that you see around your office building. I don't see very many Fitbits anymore at all. I see a lot of Apple Watches. I see a small handful of Android devices like Android Wear. And a smattering of the, what's Fitbit smartwatch? The Blaze? I think it's the Blaze.
Blaze. And my I just got my wife for Mother's Day at Ulta. Ulta or something like that.
Aria and the Ulta. Yeah. But I don't see them like I did 2 or 3 years ago. Like there were, like everybody had a Fitbit a couple of years ago. And so now Xiaomi is outselling both. So there was a report some findings from a research firm Strategy Analytics show that second quarter earnings reveal a shuffled ranking in the major wearable producers, with Xiaomi now on top for the first time. It says this time last year, Fitbit claimed the top spot with nearly 29% of the global market share, which is surprising, and maybe outside of North America, Fitbit is still king. Xiaomi and Apple trailed with 15 and 9% respectively, which... It's surprising that Apple was only at 9%, because at least among, you know, I work in an IT department and there are a lot of Apple Watches there, and I see a lot just out at the store and whatnot. I would have thought bigger than 9%. I don't know that I could tell you what one of Xiaomi's fitness wearables looks like. I know there's some cheap Chinese wearables you can get for like between $10 and $30 on Amazon. I've not really looked into any of those. But the article goes on to say, over the course of just a year, Fitbit's market share has plummeted down to less than 16%, and Xiaomi now controls over 17%. Along with a declining market share, Fitbit is also dealing with lawsuits and has laid off 110 employees earlier this year in order to cut costs. Its smartwatch project has also been struggling. There have also been a lot of rumors that Fitbit is real close now to announcing their new smartwatch, which is supposed to save the company and more directly address what Android Wear is doing and what the Apple Watch is doing, and I think even what fitness offerings from like Garmin and TomTom and what's the other big one? Polar are offering. Although
I'm skeptical.
Rumors are TomTom is exiting the smart GPS watch market. They're going to focus strictly on navigation.
So the reason, part of the reason I'm skeptical that Fitbit's watch is going to do so well is their product is already good. Like my wife really likes the Fitbit that she got. She likes getting notifications on it. She would have no interest in upgrading to a watch. And of course, if she would have any interest in that, she would be probably going to an Apple Watch, I would suspect.
Right. You know, Fitbit does a really good job. If you know a lot of people that are in the Fitbit world, their social integration is really, really good. I mean, Apple's is atrocious, and Apple has never been good at social. I don't understand how a company that has such a devoted following and dominates a lot of the markets that they're in can just for literally over a decade swing and miss and fail miserably at social. But they have time and time again. The Apple Watch sharing piece is just brain dead. It is broken and awful compared to what Fitbit has to offer. So if you're all in Fitbit and you have a lot of friends with Fitbit, the social aspect is phenomenal. No question. Where Fitbit irritates me is they have a vested interest in keeping you in Fitbit, so they do not publish or share anything natively into the Apple Health ecosystem.
Uh-oh.
Which I really like the Apple Health ecosystem. Apple's done a great job building this hub that all of these apps can connect to, and you can do all kinds of cool things. I've got a blood pressure app that I can, you know, put my blood pressure in and it'll log it into Health, and then there's a record of all of my health information. I've got, you know, I've got a smart scale and it logs everything through an app that's a stupid little app, but then it logs that into Health. So it tracks my weight and my body fat and my, you know, hydration and all of the stupid stuff that the scale tracks. You know, I've got different workout apps and they'll track, you know, whether I'm doing a run or I'm cycling or whatever. And it all logs and it all works and plays together and it's all data and it's phenomenal. And Fitbit won't dip their toe in or allow any kind of connection. There are some third-party apps that will try to extract data from Fitbit and publish it into Apple Health and vice versa to give you those integrations, but they're hacky and kludgy and junky. So, I mean, Fitbit has built their walled garden. Apple has their walled garden. I can't see it ending well for Fitbit unless this new watch is just amazing.
I'm going to spin off on this real quick because I just saw an article recently. Xiaomi has become the fourth biggest seller of smartphones worldwide, according to a new report from the research firm Gartner. So it pushed its way into the top five of all smartphone companies during the third quarter of 2014 with sales of 18.8 million units. And it only sold 3.6 million units for the same period a year ago. According to Gartner, overall sales of smartphones went up to 301 million units. Wait a minute. Is this the right article? Oh, it's the wrong article. Never mind what I just said.
Ignore all that.
I saw this recently. I'll see if I can find it quicker.
We have talked about Xiaomi in the past, and I know that they are, they are nipping at, I don't remember who was the number one smartphone producer in China, but I know Xiaomi is nipping at their heels if they are not now the number one.
I think Xiaomi just passed Vivo. That's what I remember from reading in the article.
So they are going gangbusters in the East, and I still don't think that they have much presence here in the West, in North America. It's the same problem that we've talked about, like with Oppo and their flash sales and all of the hoops you have to jump through to get the handsets, and that doesn't seem to work well in North America unless you're really, really gung-ho on getting a specific smartphone or device or whatnot.
It's really tricky here because you pretty much have to partner with the carriers.
Right.
And, you know, you have to, that's carriers plural.
Sure.
To make a dent. And they don't have a lot of, the carriers don't have a lot of incentive, right? I mean, they want to keep their SKU list short, and so to break in, they are It's hard to do. It would take a big push and a consistent push. Here it is. It says Xiaomi edges out Vivo to become the fifth largest smartphone. So they've re-surpassed Vivo, apparently.
Okay.
And here, Q2 2017, shipments of 23 million phones.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, to piggyback on what you were saying about working with the carriers, I would love to know, as the overall picture of the market, what non-carrier phone sales even look like, because
in the US.
Yeah. I mean, probably one of the biggest non-carrier phones is the Google Pixel. And yep. I mean, what have they moved? 5 million units, something like that?
Nobody knows for sure. That's probably, yeah, on the high end, I would think.
And which, I mean, that's literally nothing. I mean, not when Apple's moving 30 million iPhones a quarter, and, you know, how many units is Samsung pushing? I mean, it's got to be tens and tens of millions a quarter.
79.5 million a quarter in Q2 17 is what this report I'm looking at says. Apple was at 41 million, Huawei 38 million, Oppo 29.5, and Xiaomi 23.2, which is huge. Xiaomi was 23.2 in Q2 17 versus only 14.7 million in Q2 of 16.
Oh, that's a big change. I mean, that's yeah. Some growth. Wow.
So that's the top five worldwide. But I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen any breakdown of the US market. I don't remember seeing anything like that.
I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming that it's, you know, probably 60% Galaxy devices, probably some large percentage iPhone devices, and then all of the other stuff.
Doesn't it have more market share in the US than Samsung?
I didn't think so. I thought Samsung had slightly edged out Apple in the US market share. Apple takes all of the other categories as far as like profit and revenue per device and all of that. I mean, when it comes to the money, I think Apple is at the top of every single list. Cost of goods and gross margin and all of that stuff. But I think in terms of just bare raw numbers of physical units sold, I think Samsung has it in the US. I don't have those numbers. I wasn't even thinking we were going to go down that rabbit hole, but I'm pretty sure I've read that Samsung is the king of the hill here. I think Apple's close, but I mean, it's Samsung has the majority. Apple has almost everything else, and then it's, you know, your HTCs and your LGs and all of that. I think all of that is like 10% of the market. I mean, it's everybody else is fighting for scraps. So
wearables is a little bit of a, you know, different tech. And I found an article on another alternate tech here. A company called VR Bangers aims to provide standalone VR headsets chock full of content to fertility clinics. So that men can feel more comfortable while they do what they're supposed to do at fertility clinics.
Okay.
It's VR, man. It's a real world use for VR. The first clinic to use these headsets is the USC Fertility Clinic, part of the Los Angeles-based University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine.
So I'm thinking, do I want to put something onto my face that someone who just finished doing that has taken off of their face?
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, is a good old-fashioned video on the TV, is it not doing it for folks these days? Do I really need fully immersive? Like, I'm already, if I was in that situation, I would already be so uncomfortable to put a headset on. No, I'm out. I'm out. This is not a use for VR for me. I'm out. Oh,
well, obvious question is, like, if you're using that device, how do you see the cup? Because, you know, you're supposed to actually capture that. That's what you're there for, is to get some get a specimen to test.
Okay.
So I don't know how that works.
I hadn't even thought of that. So now you just made it even grosser in my mind. Maybe you take, like, a synthetic thing. Maybe it's a full immersive thing. Like, you know, you've got a device that goes. I need an adult. This conversation is making me really uncomfortable. That's bizarre.
My wife and I had trouble conceiving initially. So we both went tested. So right. I've been in one of these types of clinics. And of course, my wife was very concerned and like, are you going to be okay with this? And I said, honey, I've been practicing for this moment for most of my adult life.
It's game day.
I'm good.
Exactly. And, I mean, that's my point. Yeah. Do you need the extra oomph that a VR headset is going to give you? I feel like if you can't get it done with a couple of magazines and a DVD, a headset's not going to be the key that unlocks the...
You may be everything. Right. This may be a solution in search of a problem, but VR Bangers is said to be talking with other fertility centers and sperm banks to expand the program.
Now,
so
we'll see. Can I just point out that VR Bangers is an absolutely terrible name for a product that I might somehow want to associate with a medical service?
It's just a company. It's the actual product is Aura Visor. Aura visor headsets, like an Aura. That's much better, you. Right?
That's So the content provider is VR Bangers. I feel like they need a kinder, gentler. Like I wouldn't be able to keep a straight face if I was talking to a fertility specialist and they're like, "Well, we're going to have you come into our clinic. We have the latest technology. You're going to put on a VR banger on your face and take care of business." I would just be rolling around laughing. I don't think I could handle that. That's wow. Technology. That's all I can say.
All kinds of areas. What else we have here?
This is a quick little throwaway I thought was interesting. There is an app. It's a couple of weeks old now that I saw this, so the buzz around it has probably died out. It was, I believe it's iOS only. I don't know if there is going to be an Android version, but it was kind of a gimmicky thing a couple weeks ago. It was called Gudak, and I believe it's... like a Hindu name or a Korean name. And what it was a little app for your phone that gave you a disposable camera. They claim that Gudak Cam strips away all of the modern features, mainly a viewfinder and instant gratification in favor of a vintage camera experience. Here you go. The name comes from the term, and I'm going to butcher this, so I'm sorry, Koreans. Gudagali? Gudagdali. Which is an old Korean word for outdated. Apparently, there is just a tiny little viewfinder like what you'd see on the back of an old Kodak disposable camera. So you can't really frame your picture. But not only that, after you take a picture, you have to wait 72 hours for it to be developed. They wanted to simulate the old sending film off to a processor and coming back. You can also only take 24 photos per day. So you get one roll of film. Again, you're supposed to use the your best possible choice for the shot. It cost $1, so it was not free, but kind of interesting in a gimmicky way. It also had an option you could turn on to have it like light leaks and scratches and all of that to authentically age and make your photos look vintage. But I thought it was kind of an interesting idea that, we are so instant gratification. Just last week was this first day of school, and, we had to do the obligatory pictures with the kid as they wait for the bus. And between my wife and I, we took like 35 pictures of, a 7-year-old waiting, on the front porch, walking towards the bus stop, at the bus stop, getting up onto the bus. It was ridiculous. So I kind of thought that was an interesting way to change that perception a little bit.
This sounds like something I would put on my kid's phone and make them use it and say, "This is what life was like in my day. I had to walk uphill to school both ways in the snow."
There you go. The both hill, uphill both ways. Absolutely. So I just thought that was humorous. I don't know if you saw this one. There was also a story that popped up a couple weeks ago that I thought was interesting. There is a new smartwatch coming out that is claiming the title of most expensive. Although, asterisk, I don't think it is the most expensive compared to the gold Apple Edition watch from a couple of years ago, but they are claiming most expensive smartwatch, and it's cheap for a Louis Vuitton, but Louis Vuitton is jumping into the smartwatch world. I don't think I realized that they actually had a watch brand. I don't know that they are known for their horological pieces. They're probably super high-end fashion watches. More than
I'm
anything.
Guessing. I saw the announcement a few weeks ago too that they were getting into it, and you know, I'm already having trouble justifying the price for a smartwatch. I'm certainly not going to pay. Was it $2,400?
$2,450. So it is a stainless steel Tambor Horizon. Apparently, that is part of a line of traditional watches that they sell. It has a 1.2-inch circular AMOLED display, surrounded by a 24-hour dial ring, allowing easy access to time zones for major cities around the world. Because, of course, if you're a Louis Vuitton customer, you're probably a jet setter, I guess.
True.
It says it offers standard Android Wear functions like alarms, timers, weather, pedometer, and notifications for calls, emails, and messages. They make it sound like that is something fancy. I mean, that's like the bare minimum that a smartwatch has to do these days. However, it lacks an optical heart rate monitor, which really, that's kind of a swing and a miss. I mean, I feel like the sweet spot of a smartwatch is primarily notifications and health tracking. Those are the two things that really seem to lend itself to. It does have an exclusive called My Flight, which provides up-to-date flight information, and City Guide, which is a set of curated guides and services by Louis Vuitton to nearby restaurants, hotels, and historical landmarks. Apparently will be available online and in Louis Vuitton stores, and starts at $2,450. Like, who is this targeted for?
If you already like the brand, I guess, then I suppose it's something like that where, I like their suits and I want one of their watches as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems a little bit of a case of too much money syndrome, because you can get a darn nice Android watch, Apple. I mean, you know, under $500, what is it really giving you for the extra $2,000? It's not even the highest end watch that's out there. I don't understand this. And I think Tag Heuer is still making their $1,600 Android Carrera watch.
And they were going to manufacture even more than they did on the first one, because they expected sales to rise. So
that's true. And I have not seen any follow-ups on that to see if that is true or not. But it'd be interesting to see. So, yeah, Louis Vuitton fans, apparently, if you can't get enough of it, there's going to be a $2,500 Android Wear Louis Vuitton watch for you.
There you go.
I don't know if you have this one here about Amazon and Dish. Tell me more about this.
And even though this is just a rumor at the moment, but the speculation is that Dish and Amazon might team up to provide wireless service. Dish owns Spectrum, wireless Spectrum, and it's burning a hole in its pocket because they have to utilize it by the end of, I can't remember, coming up, either the end of this year or the end of next year. Otherwise, they have to basically return it and get so that it can be re-auctioned off to somebody who will use it.
Huh. Interesting.
And so, you know, Dish has been linked with deals, mergers, and buyouts involving AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint. But there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that says the latest suitor could be Amazon.
I mean, there have been rumors for a long time that Amazon would launch their own wireless service. And if I recall correctly, and I could be misremembering, but back when they were, there were rumors that they were going to be announcing their own phone. The rumors were really strongly pointing to the fact that they were going to basically become an MNO or MVNO mobile, basically a reseller of somebody, because I think, doesn't Amazon partner with Sprint for the Kindle? If you have a cellular Kindle, I think they piggyback off Sprint's network. And the rumors were that Amazon was going to A, launch a phone, and B, launch their own network to go with the phone. And then there was even a rumor that the phone was going to be free for Prime members to push adoption, which I'm obviously the the phone was right, but the wireless networking and free for Prime was not. So I don't know. That's really interesting.
And I think something like this, they would be able to, you know, kind of set it up in the Pacific Northwest, maybe as mm-hmm. as a start, and you know, kind of test market up there. If you're probably if you're a Prime member, you would get some type of deal on the wireless service too. So.
I didn't realize that Dish had spectrum in the mobile space. I know that AT&T had bought, they bought DirecTV, right? Because AT&T, yes. I don't think, is promoting UVerse anymore for television. They're trying to get everybody off of IPTV and onto satellite so that they can clear up their lines for internet stuff.
They're pushing that AT&T Direct, is it? AT&T Direct now or something like that?
Right. So. You get your wireless and your internet from AT&T, and then DirecTV provides your television content. And I don't know this is a fact, but I've read articles that basically hint at the fact that since their UVerse service was IP television, it was killing their infrastructure for things like internet access. And so they're trying to offload that burden, and, you know, pushing all of that to a satellite completely offloads the, you know, that data from their network. Because it was data when you were watching your UVerse television. So yeah, they're pushing that aggressively. That's an interesting rumor. I would like for something like that to happen, because I'd love to see a wireless shakeup. You know, I think that the time is ripe for a Google or an Apple or an Amazon to come in and, you know, become a carrier. I think that would really put a lot of pressure on, you know, Verizon and AT&T, maybe less so on T-Mobile and Sprint, because they're smaller and can be more nimble. But anything that, you know, drives competition and hopefully is a good thing for consumers, right?
Yeah, and Google is kind of breaking into that with Project Fi.
Right.
And obviously, you have a limited selection of phones right now that can use that. So.
Well, and I mean, Project Fi has been a thing for a while now, hasn't it? I mean, you could get a Project Fi phone, yeah. But I don't think it's got much adoption outside of, you know, San Francisco, New York. I don't. Can you even get Project Fi here in Indiana?
I assume so. I know someone in St. Louis who has it, and she likes it. And really? It's the cheapest way, I think, you can get cellular service. Like, if you just want to go bare bones as cheap as possible, only pay for a limited amount of minutes, but have the convenience of being able to call wirelessly, mm-hmm. I think Project Fi is tough to beat.
Other than the little tiny bit that we travel, like, that would probably suffice for most people. I feel like I have this huge fancy cellular plan, and it's primarily for those edge cases of, yeah, I'm really stuck in traffic and I'm not near enough of Wi-Fi coverage to get online, and I've got to send a text or I've got to make a call. So, I would think 80% of the time, something like Project Fi would suffice for me, but it's that 20%.
That's right.
That 20% that keeps me on Big Red.
But I mean, if you could get off of Big Red, then you could afford LastPass.
Oh God, don't make me choose. I hopefully that doesn't get that expensive.
Okay, hey, so for this next story, we gotta say, like, I gotta ask you, like, no spoilers, man.
Okay, I don't know
After this, I'm gonna watch the show, and I have avoided any of these spoilers. So not now.
Okay, so maybe we should do the next two stories out of order, because I put them in the notes backwards. But
yeah, sounds good.
So there was a big hack at HBO last week. They confirmed that somebody broke into their servers and stole an unknown quantity of data.
Lannisters.
Yeah. Well, why would they do that? They would stand to profit from people subscribing to HBO. Oh,
Littlefinger. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, probably was Littlefinger. So apparently, unreleased episodes of Ballers and Room 104 were appearing online, and as well as a script for an episode of Game of Thrones. That was the first news last week. And there was a quote from HBO... or actually I think this was from Entertainment Weekly, saying that HBO recently experienced a cyber incident. Notice they're not calling it a hacking attack or a breach. It's a cyber incident. That sounds very dainty and genteel, which
just,
results
just kinetic activity.
Yeah, just a, you know, it's a cyber oopsie, which resulted in the compromise of proprietary information. We immediately began investigating the incident and are working with law enforcement and outside cybersecurity firms. Data protection is a top priority of HBO, and we take seriously our responsibility to protect the data we hold. So when they say it took a unknown quantity of data, they later revised that to they took 1.5 terabytes of data from the company. Jeez. It is huge. There was a, I don't know if it's in this article, but in one of them I was looking at to contrast that. So the Sony got hacked, what, 3 years ago? Mm-hmm. And that was like bad. That was like the world is ending for Hollywood bad. That was like 26 gigabytes of data.
Oh my gosh.
They took
wow.
1.5 terabytes of data from HBO. So the hackers have, I guess, since come forth and said that, oh yeah, no, we stole 1.5 terabytes of data. They don't even know, and I don't know that HBO has confirmed the breadth of what has been taken. Unreleased episodes, scripts, employee data, financial information. And apparently the hackers have been leaking it online slowly. They sent an email to reporters last Sunday. So depending on when you are listening to this, this would have been like August the 2nd, something like that. July 30th. I got to do calendar math in my head, and I can't do that. They sent an email that Sunday saying, quote, "Hi to all mankind. The greatest leak of cyberspace era is happening. What's its name? Oh, I forgot to tell. It's HBO and Game of Thrones. You are lucky to be the first pioneers to witness and download the leak. Enjoy and spread the words. Whoever spreads well, we will have an interview with him. HBO is falling." So I imagine HBO is probably on full-on sphincter lockdown tightening mode. I'm sure that they are heads are rolling and people are trembling in the hallways. So yeah, it's not a good for HBO. And then later last week, the fourth episode of Game of Thrones apparently leaked out into the wild.
Wow.
Yeah, coming less than a week after they admitted their servers had been hacked and a large quantity of data had been stolen. So episode four was floating around. I actually know someone on Facebook who admitted to downloading it and watching it. I guess it was low res, like it was like 480p, like. I gotta ask, what kind of person would do that to themselves? You know it's coming out three or four days later, and you're gonna watch it in HD glory, so you download pirated content and watch it in crappy SD on your computer. Like, why?
It's not like you're getting it 6 months early or something.
Yeah.
Like, you have to wait for the season to come out.
Do you have to know it that much? Because it wasn't like they leaked all the rest of the episodes this season. It was just the one. And so apparently it was popping up all over the internet last Friday. Links from Reddit, a link to a Google Drive page that was taken offline. The thing that was interesting is that the episode had a watermark on it that said Star TV India, which is a 21st Century Fox company. I guess that was seen as confirmation that the hackers really do have this huge trove of data and video. So nobody knows what's going to happen, if the shoe's going to drop, if they're going to release other episodes or ruin series for HBO. And I'm kind of like you, Todd. I'm at a point in my life where I just want to watch my stories every week. I don't want spoilers. I don't want those jerks online who post spoilers. I don't want to know. I just want to see what happens.
Yeah, we've been talking about this at work, and I have a coworker who has like gone down all of these rabbit holes on the internet just because he's curious about theories of what's happening in the Game of Thrones universe and what this scene meant and what this scene could mean and who this person could actually be. And I'm thinking, I'm oblivious to all that. I mean, I've read the books, you know, but obviously we're past the part now where
right,
you know, we're further on in the TV series than the books have covered, and I want to watch the show, and I don't really care about the speculation and such. Besides that,
Exactly. I just want entertainment fed to me. I want the occasional dragon to show up and wreak havoc. I'm kind of the same way. Maybe that makes me a mouth breather that I don't want to like dig into all the alternate theories and the metaphors of the show or who might be related to whom. I just show me something fantastic every week and keep me entertained for an hour. That's really all I ask. My only gripe, to digress for just a second, my only gripe with this season is, it's what, 6-7 episodes? They've decided to pull that kind of what Mad Men did that last season, where they released 8 episodes, and then they took like a year-long break, and they released the second part of the season as 8 episodes and said, oh, that's it, no more Mad Men. It was those 16 episodes. But there was a year break between episode 8 and episode 9, so it was like season 8. A and season 8B, and it really irritated people. So they're kind of doing the same thing here with Game of Thrones, and they are jumping around so darn much to try and wrap everything up. And like, I stop it, give us more. I'll pay you. I am paying you. Slow it down. Let me enjoy it. Savor it.
I think I read it takes a, or it costs like $5 million an episode, though. So
is that it? I figured it would be more than that.
But there's a ton of people watching. I am kind of surprised at how many people, you know, when they get 30 million viewers or something, which these days is almost unheard of for even for network.
So this says that between 2012 and 2015, the average budget per episode increased from 6 million to at least 8 million. The sixth season budget was over 10 million per episode for a season total of over 100 million. And I think Westworld's in that ballpark of like, it was like 100, 150 million, something like that. It was just ridiculous.
And they're not, it's mostly not the actors, right? Because most of the talent is, you know, relatively new and non-famous talent. I mean, you had Anthony Hopkins in Westworld, but in Game of Thrones, I don't know who would have been the most, you know, the maybe Ned, but Ned is not counting in episodes, you know. In all the episodes. I won't spoil it for anybody. But.
Okay, I think spoiler alert. If you don't know what happened to him, it's okay. You could let people know. It was like 3 years ago.
A little bit longer, but yeah, I know. Anyway.
Okay, 2011. That makes me feel old that it's 6 years now that I've been watching this series. And you want to make yourself feel old. We were talking. Do you remember the TV show Win Ben Stein's Money?
Yes.
Okay, so we were talking at work about Win Ben Stein's Money and Ben Stein, and I said to myself, self, that was a good show. I enjoyed that show. That was like 10 years ago, right? Do you know how long ago Win Ben Stein's Money was?
Wouldn't that have been early 90s?
It was late 90s, but it was still late 90s. 20 years ago, it premiered in 97, and I feel so old now that I just thought, no, that was just like 10, maybe 12 years ago. It wasn't that long ago. No, 20 years ago.
That's a tough part for us old folks to get our minds around is that somebody says 1987. You think, oh, yeah, 1987. That was just a little while ago.
No, that was 30 years.
30 years ago.
I can't find quickly the Game of Thrones viewership. I assume it's probably one of the higher watched things, but I mean,
I know the trailer, this season's trailer, it was like 55 million views in the first 24 hours, but that doesn't mean that everybody watches the show, but still for a, you know, premium tier cable show to have that much of cultural penetration to me is pretty remarkable.
Here's an article that said that the premiere reached 30 million viewers. So if you think about it, like, what was the MASH season finale? Like 130 million? I mean, there's nothing that compares anymore. I mean, 30
million.
You have
to put it into the different eras, that's for sure. Because even something like Cheers was, I mean, what? I don't even know, but.
Well, Seinfeld. Huge. Seinfeld was probably in that era of, I bet 80 million people watched the Seinfeld finale. Because that was right before DVRs, and, you know, you had to see it. It was must-see TV, right?
Mm-hmm. It was.
You couldn't miss it. That's interesting. So HBO, man, I don't know what they're gonna do. That's gonna be bad for HBO. How long have we been going? Probably a little close to an hour. There's one more I want to hit on that I thought was really interesting. Okay. this couple of weeks old now, and the headline was way more sensational than it turned out to be, but you could definitely see where this could be used in a nefarious way. So the headline is, insanely accurate lip-syncing tech could turn fake news videos into a real problem. And basically, it turned out that this was a group of researchers at the University of Washington, and they are doing some amazing things with technology. They have developed a method that uses machine learning to study facial movements of people and to recreate and re-render the lip movement and sync it with audio that does not, so it's not real. So they are basically making a puppet, and they are making it say things, and it looks darn convincing. So for their research, they used Obama, love him or hate him, and they chose him because there's so much content of him out there available.
Sure.
And so they have built these models, but what ultimately the bottom line is, they basically have an Obama puppet that looks like it's him. He's sitting there moving. It's several minutes of video that's looped, but they can make his mouth do anything. And so they have an Obama puppet. And if you're not paying close attention, they can make him say anything they want him to say. And one of the things that they actually took an old recording of him as a law student and made it look like President Obama from 2 years ago was saying this interview from like 25 or 30 years ago. There are some videos on their website that I will link to, and you can watch it for yourself. Again, you're going to look at it and you go, something's not quite right. But you know something's not quite right. If this was just a video clip cut into like a CNN or a Fox News thing, I could see how it would fool a lot of people. And it is amazing. So it goes on to say that this new development is building on a growing body of research into creating realistic videos of people speaking without actually recording them with a video camera. There have been other attempts to do this that were achieved by recording several people saying the same sentences over and over and over again to capture the very specific mouth movements needed to make each sound. And then the computer could render that into mouth movements that mimicked those sounds. So this team at the University of Washington have streamlined the process. They basically fed it a huge quantity of footage of Obama speaking. They plugged it all into a big neural network, and then they used algorithms to determine all of the differences in mouth movements. They, again, chose Obama because there are so many hours of him speaking on video and out in the public domain. They even said that the lip-syncing problem is especially challenging because one thing that people are really good at is spotting tiny visual inaccuracies, things that aren't quite right, that aren't quite human. One of the researchers was saying, if you don't render the teeth exactly right or the chin moves at the wrong time, people spot it right away and it's going to look fake. That came from the lead author of the report, I'm not going to pronounce his last name right. Suwajanakorn. Yeah, sorry there. That's the best I can do on that name. He goes on to say, so you have to render the mouth region perfectly to get beyond the uncanny valley. For the demo, the researchers used years-old audio of Obama speaking on a talk show to a news crew at Harvard, and then create new-looking video of Obama in the Oval Office reciting the lines. It's not perfect, but it's darn close. And so you can imagine the conspiratorial implications of technology like this. The practical applications are much more mundane. For instance, the researchers think that this sort of technology would make video chat better, since a computer could generate an image of you speaking if the video feed cut out or the bandwidth dropped. So you would be seeing me in pristine HD potentially, and I would be seeing you in pristine HD instead of the little fuzzy low res as we're doing our video chat, and it would just be animating our mouths, which is kind of a little freaky. They also talked about recreating historic figures from old recordings to create videos or holograms showing them these people giving famous speeches, for museums, theme parks, things like that. Or what absolutely will happen, which is we will make people say things that they never said and we will start World War III because humans are awful. And that is what is going to happen. But it is some really kind of amazing stuff. Like I said, I'll link these YouTube videos. Go take a look for yourself and see what they're doing with this technology. It's like I said, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. And if you just, again, if you were in a bar and there was video up on a TV across the room, I don't think you'd notice it. And that's kind of a little scary. So it'll be interesting. You know, we've talked on this podcast a lot about how the laws have largely not kept pace with technology. So is this another case of, do we need legislation that says it's illegal to make someone say something that they never said because we almost have the technology to do that now?
If it's close enough and enough people find out about it, then I assume that politicians will just claim that, oh, I didn't actually say that. Somebody used that video
right
a year ago to make it look like I said that. But, I changed my mind, but I don't want to claim that I actually said that back then. So that'll be the first use.
Sure. But I mean, at some point it becomes, you know, then it becomes, politician aside, any public person, you know, can they use that to defend otherwise indefensible positions to, you know, if they have extreme opinions and now they can say, well, that's not really me. That somebody made me say that. And it's going to be much harder to say, no, we actually have footage of you saying this, as opposed to, well, now we've got to dissect the footage and find out if it was altered and tampered with, or if it was created out of whole cloth. I don't know. It's an interesting part of the time.
Yeah, I mean, the national people, I don't know. I mean, the way that you'll be able to vet it is that you'll have several reporters with the same footage, right? I recorded it this way, and this is what we played, and then so and so was there, and they recorded it the same way. So that'll be a way to kind of verify it. But for national politicians, or as you said, public figures, it could be a bigger issue. In theory, you hope that there is a way to dissect it, that another computer can go in and say, yes, that was definitely altered. But even then you wonder.
Well, and, you know, I mean, a lot of times politicians speak in places where they're not necessarily expecting there to be coverage. I think it was video coverage. And it really, I think, bit Mitt Romney in the butt, where he was talking about the 43% comment, 48% comment. And I don't know that that was a recorded event, other than someone there happened to be recording it. And, you know, so then you're in a case of, well, of course I didn't say that. They made a computer say I said that. I don't know. It's an interesting time we live in, and it'll be curious to see how we adapt to it, or humanity will just implode, which is, I'm betting on the latter.
I don't know. I have to admit that if there's some way that they don't have to use the actual bandwidth for the video feed to work, that can only be helpful. 'Cause that seems to be a big stumbling block in a lot of, video chat communications or video conferencing situations.
Yeah, maybe if it was more of a one way, like a company president giving a video conference speech out to the company. But there's a lot of nuance that you get that you miss out on that you wouldn't get if it was a pre-recorded loop of their head with their mouth being rendered in real time. Now, that might make sure that every employee out there saw an HD quality rehearsed version of that speech. But if you're just chatting one-on-one in a business setting, there's a lot you can pick up on by, you know, a person's body language, what their face is doing. I don't know.
Very true.
I don't know how I feel about that, and I'm a technologist. did you have
no
any?
No stopping it. No,
yeah, unfortunately, that's true. You can't stop technology. Did you have any average Android stuff that you wanted to talk about this episode?
I think we've been going long enough. Let's wrap this one up, and maybe we'll come back with some Android stuff next time we record. I know I've got some more information on my new phone, my U11 that I'll pass along at some point. But
very cool.
For now, Jacob, why don't you talk about what you love?
Okay, so as my wife is quick to point out, when I tackle a new hobby, I tend to go in whole hog. Why half-ass something when you can whole-ass it? That's my motto. And I've talked a little bit about it on the podcast, but I've been doing more jogging and trying to get healthy and running races and all that fun stuff. And in my ever unsatiable quest for more data, Why I'm collecting so much data, I don't know, but I like to quantify doing something, because if it's not quantified, did I really do it?
No.
No, absolutely. You probably understand the lust for data. I found a cool little gizmo. It's called a Milestone Pod. It's like a $22. Price fluctuates a couple of bucks up and down, but right around 22 bucks on average. You can get them on Amazon. I mean, it's a little foot pod that you clip onto the laces of your shoe, and it tracks all sorts of interesting metrics about your running. So it tracks your distance, it tracks number of steps, it tracks cadence, it tracks your pace. It also has a shoe odometer, and it also tracks your foot ground contact time. It tracks your ankle swing, your foot strike position, whether you're striking with your heel, if you're striking with your midfoot, or if you're toe striking, and your rate of impact, which is how hard your foot is hitting the ground. Are you hitting the ground gently? Are you hitting the ground jarringly? And so you don't have to really think about it. You just clip this little thing on your shoe. It's bigger than a quarter, smaller than a half dollar. Adds like probably 3/4 of an ounce. You don't even notice it. And you just go run. You don't have to do anything to it. You don't have to turn it on. It wakes up when you go, and there's a little app that it syncs with. It will also sync live Bluetooth data to a lot of popular apps. So if your app supports it, like Strava, I don't know if Runkeeper does. I know there's a handful of iOS-specific running apps. Run Meter, iSmooth Run, a whole bunch of them that will connect to it and get cadence information right from it as you're running. So it's recorded in your app. And it gives you all kinds of additional information. Like, I know if my form is starting to suffer, it shows me how my foot is hitting the ground. It shows me.
Do you get that while you're actually running?
I guess if you were looking at the app, you could kind of see it, but it's really more for after the fact analysis.
Okay. Gotcha.
And a good example. So if I do a shorter run, my form will be better. And I did a longer run today, and towards the end, I could really start to see my ground contact time went way up, which meant that my form was starting to fall apart because I'm not used to running that far. So again, I don't know what I'm going to do with the data, but I love getting the data. And it's only like I said, $22 to put one on your shoe. It's really darn accurate. It's amazing how well it tracks distance too. So with GPS, you're kind of at the mercy of, if you lose a satellite or you're under some trees, your route could be a lot longer or a lot shorter than you think it is. But once you get this thing dialed in, and you have to run a few times for a fairly known distance, and then there's some calibration stuff that you give it. Like, it was within like 100 yards of the run, according to my GPS tonight. And so you can actually have a lot of apps extract their distance from that. So it can be a much more accurate, if you're not sure, did I run 3.1 or 3.2 or, 2.95, it'll tell you exactly how far you run. It's a neat little gizmo. Like I said, it's only $22. Check one out if you're at all jogging or like data analytics and that kind of stuff. It's a cool little gizmo. So it's called the Milestone Pod. I'll put a link to it on Amazon. Very cool. Neat little gadget. To get one from one of the big makers, like a Garmin, they're like $60. This is $22. You can't go wrong with it. So that is what I love. Todd, how about you?
So this is probably a little bit late because I'm not sure it's out in theaters anymore, but I went and saw the movie The Big Sick, and it's outstanding. This rom-com, romantic comedy, stars Kumail Nanjiani, Zoe Kazan, Ray Romano, and Holly Hunter.
Okay.
It was written by Kumail and his real-life wife, Emily Gordon. And it tells the story of how they met and the huge curveball that life threw them while they were dating. So it's well acted, it's funny, it's touching, it's everything a romantic comedy should be, and I highly recommend it as a couple's movie. It's very funny. I really enjoyed it.
So I love Kumail Nanjiani, however you say his last name.
Nanjiani.
I don't even know the first place I saw him, but I've seen him in a handful of things. He's in Silicon Valley. I wanted to go see this. I think my wife even mentioned saying, oh, that looks cute, but we never made it out to the theater. So you're saying it's definitely worth at least a pay-per-view or something like that, right?
It definitely is. I'm just, I know in the theater that I walk by pretty regularly at lunch, it's not on the whatever marquee anymore. It's not at the box office as a selection. So it may not be in theaters anymore. I don't know. Don't know how well it did. But he does a very good job in this movie. Acting and such. So
it looks like it's still playing in some of the bigger theaters away from the downtown area.
Okay, good.
Yeah, there's three within, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes of me that look like they're playing it at least for the next few days.
It will be well worth your time and money.
Okay, well, I will have to check it out. I like I said, I remember seeing some trailers for it and going, oh, I like him. That looks funny. I didn't know anything about it more than it was like a rom-com chick flick and that he's in it, and that makes me laugh.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah, he has some good lines. All right, well, I think that'll do it for another episode of the No Better Than Average Show. If you would like to call in to our comment line, please do. It's 317-643-1212. You can join our newsletter at nobettershow.com/join. Look us up on Facebook, facebook.com/nobettershow, or on the Twitters, @nobettershow. And now that you have listened to another episode, we hope that you know better than average too. Talk at you later, everyone.
Have a great week, everybody.